Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of Reckless Atalk, our TTRPG interview show where we sit down with some of our favorite writers, players, GMs, and streamers to get to know a little bit more about what makes them who they are. I am, as always, your host, GM Nathan. I use he, him pronouns, and I am so happy to present to you this frankly long overdue, very inspirational, and very fun interview with game designer and shitpost legend Lex from Titanomachy RPG. We talk about this a little during the actual episode, but Lex started a little ahead of us in the tabletop gaming space and was always somebody that I personally looked up to. Super creative, hardworking, consistent, and generally generous with their time and expertise, plus incredibly funny and thoughtful. Lex has designed many games across a variety of genres and systems, but they are probably best known for their Caltrop Core System Reference Document, or SRD. Now, for those who don't know, an SRD is essentially a general skeleton for creating a game system that everyone can use usually for free and usually with attribution. Caltrop Core focuses in on using the black sheep of the dice set, the D4, and gives you several quick ways to generate stats, dice pools, and or a token-based TTRPG using a handful of the spiky little dice. As of last count, at the publishing of this episode, more than 230 games have been published through Caltrop Core, and the document itself has been downloaded more than 2,000 times. It's really a wonderful tool that gave a lot of people just enough to create their own things, which means Lex has genuinely helped a lot of people realize dreams. In this episode, we talk about Caltrop Core, but also about self-expression, depression, perseverance, the importance of failure and growth, and shitposting. As always, if you enjoy this episode, please go check out some of our other Reckless Talk interviews and maybe even our actual play episodes. We have links to the things that Lex and I talk about in the show notes, including a Nighthawks VOD featuring some friends of the show, and links to all of their games over on Itch. So please go check all that out and support them as they give full-time game design a whirl. With that, I'll see you next time. Hello, Lex.
Hi, how's it going?
It is going so well because I am so excited to be chatting with you here today.
I'm excited too.
I like can't fully express how like truly, genuinely excited I am to get down, get dirty, talk about all the good Lex things.
I'm grateful that you wanted to talk to me and that it seems like something people want to hear. So I am always happy to know that people enjoy hearing me on podcasts and stuff and inviting me onto podcasts and continuing to invite me on podcasts as well, which is a different thing and is also very, I'm also very grateful.
Yeah, I mainlined so many Lex podcasts the last like week or so, and they have all been a delight. So I personally can continue to say, yes, I do enjoy hearing you blab on podcasts and other such formats. Well, Lex, so for those people who have not listened to as many Lex-centric podcasts as I have in the last week, and I'm not, you know, generally as familiar with your work as I am or you are, could you please tell everyone who you are, your pronouns, all that good stuff?
Sure thing. Yeah. My name is Lex. I'm also known as Titanomachy RPG online. I use they, them pronouns. And I am a trans game designer who grew up in Florida and is, as of recently, no longer in Florida for safety reasons. But I'm really happy to be here and things are looking up.
And hey, you know what? I think things are looking up is like such a high watermark post like 2020, oh, you know, yeah. Or maybe post 2016 that like, hell yeah, very exciting.
Yeah, just people being like, yep, well, at least it wasn't 2020, 2021, or 2016, or you know what, we've got some low bars that we can just step over.
Yeah,
and sometimes
hopefully.
You need that.
That's
you need a little win.
Yeah, exactly.
Get the ball rolling.
But, you know, hey, Lex, you have made so many different games. You have appeared on, again, a bunch of different shows as both the interviewed and as a player and game runner and done all kinds of stuff. But, you know, that's not where we start on Reckless the Talk. We like to dig deep. We like to find that kernel of that little acorn that grew into, is it oak, right? That acorns?
I believe so.
The tree that it grows into, that is the you who you are today.
Well, it obviously grows into an acorn tree.
Oh my God. How did I miss that? I don't know. Man, that just is like my city roots showing, I guess.
Yeah.
No further tree pun intended. Can you just kind of start with how you got introduced to tabletop role-playing games, just kind of as a concept and or, you know, kind of like nerdery, I guess, in general, wherever your preferred origin story starts?
Yeah. So I started as like video games as a child. And I also used to draw and read a lot. So I read a lot of, you know, fantasy and sci-fi as a kid. And I played a lot of Game Boy Advance and GameCube growing up. I was like a Nintendo kid, but not Mario or Link, Legend of Zelda and stuff. I could never like quite get into them. But all the other stuff, I just loved all sorts of that like 32-bit era of pixel art right before everything goes full 3D. I guess the GameCube also had full 3D. And that's a whole, that was also big console for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's always fun looking back, and that generation of game consoles come up a lot in this show.
Yeah.
And everyone has very strong opinions about where things were. And GameCube is, I would say, maybe the most frequent answer.
I mean, yeah. I mean, GameCube is great. On the Game Boy Advance, one of the scariest games, probably to this day, the most fear I've felt playing a video game was probably Metroid Fusion on Game Boy Advance, where the copy of you is hunting you down. There's different sections where that happens, and you don't know when they're going to happen when you're a kid. And the thing will like legitimately kill you if you cannot get away. So it's just like the real fear of this thing that looks like Samus hunting you down. And one time I got away, and they were turning around, and my hands were so shaky, I accidentally set a power bomb and it exploded. And then the thing came and killed me. And I was like, that's not my progress for a while. Cause I was like, this is so stressful to try. Meanwhile, I'm like 11 years old. And it's to this day, that game is so good at invoking fear. And I think that also is a sort of predecessor to my current love of horror and like certain horror elements. And then in like 2018, my brother, who's also a big nerd, my younger brother, we played GameCube growing up together all the time. We used to play this game called Gotcha Force together, like 1,000, maybe more hours on it. Like, he started running 5e for us using the like starter kit, the Mines of Phandelver. And we were all still learning how to play the game. And he had kind of figured some stuff out. And then I started listening to Adventure Zone and kind of picked up the rhythm of play from them. And then I started running games for my table about 6 months after we started playing. And my brother was in it. A couple of my best friends were in it. And I did a very me thing, which was like homebrew everything right from the start and like made custom classes for my friends, except I didn't really know how to do that at the time. I know how to do that now. But at the time, I was just like giving them cool stuff that I know they would like because I knew them really well and knew what kind of like video gamey type stuff they liked. So that was really fun and gratifying. And you know, we got like a good year or two into it. And then, of course, pandemic totally messes things up.
Yep.
And I go online and I start the Twitter account for Titanomic RPG to start doing like an actual play show with my friends just to have something to do.
Was it going to be the same group of people?
It was going to be two of the people from that group and one other person. People that I knew would work together well with me and each other. And that series was called Titanomic RPG. And then I was like, all right, well, I'm on Twitter. I wanted to drum up some audience before we started because we were still like developing the show and getting art and stuff. So I went online and I was trying to figure out what to do. I don't have like a social media marketing background, but I do have a copywriting, digital marketing background. Mm-hmm. So I started doing a little series of like character prompts where I would give like a weird multi-class in 5e and then people would comment to come up with a backstory that would make all of it make sense together. And I found that really fun because I really like wacky combinations in everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how I met Email Master Over Space over at Double DM and probably a bunch of other people from the space. And eventually I started making my own like 5e stuff. I largely got, I think my first good idea, like really good idea for like getting more reach with the account was just making really wild off the wall subclasses.
Oh yes.
Cause I love the job system in games. I love classes. I love like growing up, I loved Fire Emblem on the Game Boy Advance cause of the like promotion system and all the stuff and the sprites and how all the animations would go. And I just, that's to this day, that's my favorite thing. So I like will write playbooks and then try to make a game around playbooks sometimes. Cause I'm just like, well, what is the experience of that person? And that's the fun for me is looking through character options and being like, ooh, these are all like really cool mechanics. These are cool like story ideas. I find them really evocative and just like the most interesting part of TTRPGs in general, but also at least TTRPGs that have them, and as well as in 5e. And then I also did like, you know, weird shit post items and oh, spells.
Yes. Oh yes.
I had a P is stored in the balls spell.
That was the one that jumped, like that's like the iconic one for me, you know, of your you have a lot of wild creations, but
it was my like most liked tweet for a while, which is very funny. Apparently, I don't know if it was that one or if the Rickroll spell made it over to Facebook. Like it was one of those two spells that like someone sent me a screenshot of it being, you know, going viral or like, you know, just being shared widely on Facebook. I'm like, all right, I made it. I jumped platforms. But then of course I also have a background in creative writing. So my background is very much like video games plus poetry and some fiction and stuff, literary fiction as a genre, not saying that that's better than any other genre. Just that's what I was trained in. And
yep.
For better or for worse, that's the genre I studied in college. Nowadays, I like to do sci-fi stuff and all any manner of weird game. I'm very much down for.
Already, you've brought up so many interesting things that I want to ask you a billion questions about. So first, something that I thought was really interesting is, you know, you talking about wanting to kind of immediately start homebrewing stuff, and how that was just like a primal urge that needed to be sated for you, even before, you know, like delving too deep into the mechanics of the game of like swapping things out and doing all kinds of stuff. So for you, where does that drive come from? Either then kind of looking back or still now to be kind of tinkering with systems, to be swapping out flavor, to be kind of delivering on different experiences for different games, different people.
Yeah, I always had sort of a creative streak as a kid. I drew a lot. I found my old drawings when we were moving and I was like, oh, cool. Like this Amazing. Is, it's like, you know, it's exactly what you think. It's perfect. It's a childhood notebook full of drawings. And I would also read a lot. So I guess creativity was a big part. I played guitar growing up and I played a lot of guitar for church before I left Christianity, but I used to play electric guitar for a mega church. Like, I mean, I think I had over 1,000 service hours just in high school.
Yeah.
And then I would play for the youth group every Wednesday night. And then like once a month or so, I would play on the weekends with the adult band. And we were a mega church that was still not big enough for like the number of attendees. So it was like Saturday and Sunday. I remember one time I played the Christmas, and for Christmas, they do like 10 services. And so I remember playing Christmas one year and it was like, I think it was like 12 performances.
You said that like it was some sort of like a battle, you know?
So yeah.
I remember playing Christmas 2028. Like, yeah. Oh man, terrible.
Brutal Christmas. So I think where I reached my, well, there's a lot of reasons for stopping guitar, including its attachment to that whole thing in my experiences and memory, but also because at the time it wasn't as easy to just like get up and make music and like do your thing with, because this was, I mean, now I sound like an old head, but it was probably, I was like in early college when I was trying to like make, try to make my own music. So 2009, 2010-ish. So, you know, 15 years ago now.
Oh God, that's the worst thing you've ever said.
Right.
In the history of the world. Because I think we are almost exactly, if not roughly the same age. And
yeah,
that's, don't say that shit.
So yeah. Is it, what the fuck did you just say to me? Like, no. So it was getting easier, and I had like people in the worship band who would like try to hook me up with tech and stuff, like weird boxes that I had to hook the computer up to and the guitar things. It was a whole thing. And I think that really like killed my love for guitar as well as the other stuff, is like not being able to create with it. Cause I think once I get to the point where I'm like, okay, I've gotten all the basics down. I have like a lot of experience playing in bands. I could create stuff and record it and it would be cool. And I like sort of got into it, but I could never get the guitar in there. So I was just using like a MIDI controller and like messing around and mixing stuff very poorly. And I, to this day, don't know how to mix stuff. It seems like magic to me. Like my ears can't hear what I'm supposed to change. It's like, it sounds bad. How do I fix it? But I also was started like taking writing seriously as a craft in like 10th grade in English. You know, you have an English teacher who,
yeah,
I think it was an Onion headline, who's like, English teacher ruins child's life by saying they could be a writer, which I don't feel that way anymore. But it's, you know, I did creative writing and economics in college, but I got a BA in economics, so it's functionally useless.
Yeah.
But I do understand basic like labor theory and economics and statistics. So that helps with games and the games that I make, which are very like leftist anarchist themed games.
Yep.
So it all came around. But no, yeah. So I realized the other day I've been writing for, I'm going to be 32 in a little bit here. So when I was 15, probably or so, I had that conversation. So 16, 17 years of writing in different forms as a job for the last 7 years before I went full time into tabletop games.
Mm-hmm.
I did that digital copywriting, like sales writing. I did fiction and poetry in college. I did some like travel writing for freelance things. That's the least fun of the things, but writing games has been a great way for like the analytical part of my mind and the creative part of my mind to come together and like reinforce each other with interesting mechanics, and having like math represent some sort of emotional truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've done all sorts of writing. I've been published with poetry and in a little bit in fiction, and that was sort of my game plan in life before I graduated college, and I was going to go to grad school, and then decided at the last minute not to go. And then I didn't have a job. So I was just like doing nothing for a good part of, you know, 2009. I got a job at Teavana in the mall, which is a company that doesn't even exist anymore.
But I remember Teavana, damn it.
I think they exist as a brand.
Yeah. Yeah. It could be, maybe it's like an online something or
like
other.
Starbucks bought them, and now they just have like Teavana brand stuff.
Oh yeah.
I think something like that. Anyway, I worked there, and then I got a gig at a like alternative health online marketing place. And then I jumped from there after 9 months to financial side of things. So now I have like all this, I guess it's, I was going to say useless. It is useful financial knowledge, but it is like dark. When I talk about it to H, my partner, I call it blood magic, because it feels, it's like, this shouldn't work. And I'm really selling a part of my soul to do this, but that is sort of the only way to, that's how I've, the only way I've been able to make this plunge to full time. It's not self-sustaining whatsoever. And it wasn't ever on my plans really, but I got to a point with my job where it was like getting to a point where, in order to improve the sales and stuff, because I was doing sales writing, I would have to put in so much more. I was putting in so much work already, so it felt like more work on top of that was just, I couldn't, I was like, if I'm going to work that hard, I'm going to work for myself. And so when we made the move, I also left my job, because I was like, all right, we'll do all the big decisions at one time.
So it sounds a little bit like that kind of creative energy and that kind of ooh, futzing with mechanics and like this, the, I don't know, solidness of mechanics, is what kind of like immediately grabbed you and was like, oh, this is what I want to be paying attention to. But to do that for a home group is very different than doing it, even, you know, than doing anything publicly, whether it is game design or an actual play, as it was kind of originally proposed. Yeah. So for you, you're already listening to shows. You're already kind of aware that obviously these things existed. But what was the draw for you to start dipping a toe into like public visibility in your tabletop kind of like creative stuff? Again, even though it changed what you were actually doing, but you still and, you know, came in with the intention of, hello, perceive me and the works that I wrought.
It comes a lot. I think I've had that impulse for a long time. It was very well realized when I was doing poetry in college, because we would have open mic nights and stuff. And poetry feels, at least for me, and when you do classes, you have to show your work to other people.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know, for me, it always felt like a natural step to, it didn't feel like it was like done cooking until I had shown it to someone in a lot of cases.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, I'm not necessarily looking for approval, although it's nice and I always appreciate
sure.
it.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
It's more like the impulse to share my art and in whatever form it takes has been there for a long time. I guess I even was like, I did performance a lot as a kid growing up, and I did guitar for church. I even was like in children's choir when I was really little. And then I also always end up dating theater kids, like people, former theater kids. Mm-hmm. I was not a theater kid, but I do have some performance hours under my belt. So it's just like the public expression of it has never scared me that much. I think it comes naturally to me in a lot of ways, or it's just the way I was raised, or I don't know, maybe it's an Asian cultural thing. I'm my mom's Korean, and there's a lot of like showing off your children type of culture, and that, you know, I think every culture has it, but there's a, all my Asians know, like there's a specific kind of way that shit goes down, and makes you pretty tough in a lot of ways to like, it's like, well, there, the, as like, you know, ruthless as Twitter can be, but you know, they're not Korean ajummas. They're not like, you know, your obachan. They're not these, you know, these old folks who will tear you. I don't know. Maybe it's also like just immigrant parents, I think. Because like, I know my friends who have immigrant parents are just like, yep, this is.
Yep.
I mean, they're tough.
Same
on us,
but different kind of yeah, experience.
Yeah. Tough on us, but for loving reasons. But they could really, you know, dig in. And so being comfortable with that level of scrutiny, I guess. I'm theorizing here, of course. probably factored into that as well. It seems like something that I just like, it felt like I guess with poetry, and I would send my poetry to like almost perfect strangers, and that would be like, you know, people you meet, new friends at parties or people you meet on a dating app. And I think I really felt like it was maybe not the only way, but the best, by far the best way for people to understand me and like see inside what I'm like thinking about all the time.
Yeah. First of all, I think I want to ask, is that kind of desire for self-expression, like, is that kind of the core of a lot of the stuff that you do? I mean, obviously there's like a degree of just like meme central and like people like when I make spells called Baja Blast.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that even there is like a degree of like personality and of kind of self, and like your suite of games, which not even including the monthly RPGs, I think is like a dozen plus or something like that.
Something wild.
Of variety. Right. It was enough that I looked at your itch page this week and I scrolled for a while and was like, yep, a lot of games.
Here's some comfort for you. I haven't gotten around to playtesting them all. So it's, the ones that are pay what you want, I probably haven't playtested it.
Well, so that'll be my next question a bit. But so yeah, is that something that's kind of like, whether it's game design or kind of other artistic expression, that you, I don't know, kind of find yourself drawn to and find, you know, kind of find reoccurring, maybe as much as anyone kind of doing that sort of work, but, you know, is something that you care about and kind of prioritize.
It's sort of like, yes, to answer your question, but also it's not even like how I normally think about it, I guess, at this point, because I went through that like very trudgy period of trying to keep writing every day and all that stuff. And I did my best. I did pretty good. I think over the years, I haven't stopped writing for longer than a few months, probably, maybe a year at the most. And the drive is innate. I think it's not even like self-expression, because I did the poetry so that people could understand me better.
Right. Yeah.
But I think with writing in general, but I find myself, whenever I try something new, the excitement of like all the things that I still have to learn is one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
Trying new stuff. And with writing, I have not felt like I've ever like plateaued or had nothing left to learn or anything like that. It's like always offered another challenge, another way of navigating the world. Like, you can order words in a certain way and people will give you money sometimes. And then with poetry, you can make someone cry, or there's all these like magic spells that writing can do. And like also by the nature of, you know, speaking as well, but like communication is,
I think that makes total sense.
Yeah. It's the sort of thing where I would do it even if I did it for a long time not getting paid, and now I'm doing it not getting paid very much at all. or I'm paying myself out of my savings, you know, and that's worth something.
Mm-hmm.
I would just do it. I would write even if there was no reason to. Like, it just sort of, I remember going to a talk in college. There was a professor from, I think, UC Riverside or something, who came to give us a talk on like creative writing and stuff. And he does this very intense thing, which I'm not really sure about the ethics of, but basically like kind of drills into the students asking like, why do you write? And then, you know, they would give an answer, and it's always like, it's like not good enough. You have to like get to the core of it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the answer, he was like, the closest someone's gotten to like getting it, like understanding what I'm trying to get at, was someone who answered, I write because I like it, or I write because I want to.
Yeah.
And that is sort of how I feel about it as well. It's like my default mode is I'm going to hole up into my little desk in the corner and tinker, even while there's like people over and, you know, they're watching stuff. I'm still participating, but I'm like, I'm tinkering, I'm writing, I'm doing stuff, or maybe I'm just playing a fighting game. But you know, largely, if I've gotten myself to stop writing, I will be playing a fighting game. But usually I default to writing. I'm like, all right, this is just something I sit down to do now after 17 years of like continuously doing it. Now it doesn't feel like a struggle to write all the time or write every day.
Yeah.
And now I don't feel the pressure to write every day. That kind of connects to like a big epiphany I had a couple years ago for mental health stuff and writing. So I in my priorities, and I don't think I had expressed it to myself literally until a while after I had kind of destroyed my inner thoughts with this pattern of behavior and thinking. But I wanted to be a great writer first, and then happy second. And then I think one day I'd done a round of therapy. Maybe it was my second round. I go in little spurts. It's like when I need it, I know I need it, and I go ask for help. And I remember thinking, well, what if I just flip those two?
Yeah.
Like, it's not, number two is not important. And what if I just decided I wanted to be happy first and then a great writer second? And it really, that moment I remember, because it really changed my approach to everything and changed my approach to writing. It changed my approach to life. And it doesn't mean that, I've certainly become a better writer since then. It's been a couple of years since that epiphany. And it feels like I get to be a writer rather than being a sort of like captive to this beast, which a lot of people feel that way. I did feel that way for a long time about writing, especially if you write fiction. I did novel course in college, and you know, that is a lot. If anyone has written a novel, even if it's not published and it's not, even if it's your fourth draft, like I've rewritten the thing three times and it's still not good. Like that is a Herculean thing and you should be proud of yourself. That is hard, hard work. But I didn't want to live like that. I didn't want to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I did want to live like that for a while. And then I realized, well, I'm miserable. Well,
yeah. Maybe. You realize maybe I deep down, I don't want to live like this.
Maybe I should want something else.
Yes.
Which is right. Also the name of my dating life back before I was with my wonderful partner, H. Now we've been together for 2 years, 3 years in 3 years in July, I think. But, you know, back in the day.
Yeah. That really resonates with me, too. I am also kind of in my process of trying to flip the priorities and kind of whatever that looks like. So for you, what does make you happy in this process? You know, like what part about the creation of things and specifically of game design? Like what is the thing for you? Like what's the high that you chase where it's like, I will know that this is a successful effort if blank, you know, if this happens for me, even if no one downloads it, even if it's not a smash success, even if I make no money. I mean, obviously, again, that's number two. Those are all nice things that you do still want. But in terms of that point one, am I happy with the process? Mm-hmm. What's the measure of success, I guess, for you?
I do a lot of it by feel.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it comes down to how the game feels, primarily when you're writing it, and then first when you're writing it, and then second when you are playtesting it. The feel of it is very important. I've always had a fascination with intuition and how humans can like do amazing complex things with just muscle memory and instinct, and I always wanted to develop that. So it's something I value, and I wanted to do that over the years. And I think with art, and when you do, especially if you do like go to school for art, you get all these critiques from people, even if you're not a writer, any type of art that you do, and you're doing workshop, you're doing studio class, and you have critique. And through that process, at least for me, I felt like you have to learn who to listen to and who not to listen to.
Yep.
And when, because sometimes it's a good idea in general, but it's not what you were going for. And so it would actually weaken, it would make it a stronger art piece in general, but it would weaken the thing that you were, your intent. Mm-hmm. It would weaken your intent. And so knowing who generally understands what you're going for. And, you know, if someone's like, I don't even like this thing, but here's what I think you should do. It's like, well, maybe they're right, but I mean, probably not. Like,
yeah.
You really want to discern what kind of feedback that you take, and the ones that like sting more and you don't want to take it, those are probably the ones that you do need to keep. But then also there's ones where it stings because of how stupid the person is, and you're like, I can't even
it's like you weren't even paying attention to the things that I was saying and doing.
It's like, oh, what if we did a completely different thing? It's like, that's not what we're talking about. Please participate in this cover anyway. So I think when I'm designing, I'm looking for, there's a certain feeling like when you play a good tabletop game and you play, even when it's not like perfect or, you know, it's got some rough edges or there's some stuff missing, you play it and you like, is there something here? And usually, you know, like yes or no. And, you know, if the answer is no, there's nothing here, that doesn't mean you have to throw it away. It just means you got to add something there, which is a playtest that I just ran for. I'm working on an Anarchist Bunny Girl RPG that's going to be a full release for everyone, not just Patreon. That one's coming later this year. I playtested it recently and I was like, I was shocked at how little was, I was like, how did I write all this and there's nothing here?
Where's all the game?
I wrote so much game in. I wrote so much game and then there's nothing, there's no game.
Yeah.
I spent 24 hours kind of stewing and thinking about it, and I came up with a solution, but that's part of the process. I think for creatives, it's important to learn how to trust yourself and trust like what you want to do. And if someone's advice or their criticism would make your thing better, but it wouldn't make you happy, then don't do it. It doesn't, it's not you know, this is for you. So, but a lot of people have trouble listening to themselves and what they want because of, and I did for a long time too. Christianity tells you to deny your cross and follow Christ and, you know, it's the sins of the flesh, this, that, and the other. But I think learning how to listen to my own thoughts and being able to understand which ones are like constructive mm-hmm. thoughts and which ones are destructive thoughts and which ones are like, you kind of give yourself a pep talk, you know, like, and be like, hey, no, this is, it's okay. And you just have to tell yourself it's gonna, like, it's fine. It's not that serious or whatever it is. You have to learn to love yourself. If you don't love yourself, you're probably gonna be like, well, all my ideas are stupid. So whatever this person says is probably better than what I have. So I'm gonna do what they want. And, you know, maybe it works. Who knows? But it's not going to be the thing you wanted to make. And as someone who has always made weird stuff, especially like my novel in college was incomprehensible. All three versions of it to this day, incomprehensible. But I knew what I wanted to do with it. And, you know, people would be like, oh, you should do this thing. And I'm like, that's the opposite of what I'm trying to do. So no, I know what you're going for. I see the technique, not what I'm going for, but thank you. Anyway, you have to know what you want. And if you try to make what everyone else is making, it's just going to fall into the sea of noise of all the other, you know, Kickstarters, whatever, itch.io store pages and all that. You have to really be you, because if they can get what you're doing somewhere else, there's probably going to be someone else out there who's better at that than you. Like, you can just assume, like, I've only been doing, like, it'll be about 3 years now that since I posted my first game on Itch. I'm still quite new, and there's people out there with decades of experience on me, and they know game mechanics. They've seen every permutation of the D6 roll, and you know, they've forgotten more about the World of Darkness than I will ever know. And I mean, I love World of Darkness, so but the advantage you can have, you can't have the advantage in experience a lot of the times, or even skill, unless you're a once in a kind of generation genius or something. But you gotta, in order for you, your voice to stand out in like the cacophony that is social media, it has to be unique. And it has to be, the only way to do that is to, like, I don't want to say double down on all your qualities, but sort of,
Lean into it. Like, authentic you possible.
Yeah, just really be just loud about it. Because I've written some really weird stuff and people have been into it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that totally makes sense. And I think that also is very evident in the stuff that you do and write.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Tumblestrom's Tome of Unicorns. This new book by Lucas Anderson offers 10 brand new unicorns and unicorn-themed stat blocks for 5th edition, including the Goopy Oozicorn, the Primeval Unicorn, and the Unicorn of Majesty. Each is accompanied with lore and plot hooks to inspire GMs using them for their campaign. There's also a section of unique magic items like the Bow of Fecundity. That's fun to say. Plus, all that is set to super evocative rock and roll zine art. Tumblestrom's Tome of Unicorns is a very flavorful and easy-to-use supplement and can be found right now on the Dungeon Masters Guild. That's TUMBLESTRUM'S, Tome of Unicorns. Available now on the Dungeon Masters Guild.
Hi, it's me, Sophie. Do you want more Reckless Attack? Then join our Discord and chat with us in our community. The link for the Discord is in the show notes, or head on over to our website, recklessattack.com. We also have a Patreon. You can listen to our new show, Reckless Snack, and other content if you become a patron. We really appreciate your support, and thank you for listening to the episode.
So, Lex, I want to talk first a little bit about one of your many kind of games and systems that you have. but of Caltrop Core. Can you just kind of just first give the base rundown of what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So Caltrop Core is what I'm best known for in the community. It is a really simple rules light D4 system for making your own TTRPG in minutes. I think the record, literally, someone said, might have been Soul from Soul's Rules. It was like 15 minutes, like before
yeah, I believe it.
Even got out of bed. Like, and it started as a joke between me, Maps and Quests, and Eli from Mayday Roleplay, just talking about doing a D4 pool system, like kind of like World of Darkness, but with these pointy buggers that we've all got in our sets.
Yep.
And I think Mappy said, like, oh, we could call it Caltrop System. And I kept it for a little bit. And then before it was too late, I changed it to Caltrop Core. And so we had that joke. And after that, I was like thinking about, oh, maybe I could use that and try to design a game, see if it does anything. So I wrote down the 1, 2, 3, 4 table. It's like essentially the same since then.
Yeah. And it's just dice pool building and tokens, basically, like are the two kind of settings. And it is like, here are the stats that you're like, here's the number of stats you can have. Here's basically how the numbers work. But like, use this template and run.
Yeah, you'll roll your pool of D4s. You take the highest result, reference the table. 1 is bad, 4 is good, and it kind of, there's some interesting nuances between, but I posted it because I was like, oh yeah, this is kind of cool. It was like a one page, I think, posted an image of it, and people started using it immediately. And I recognized that this was like a special thing, because if you've ever made anything online, you know how hard you have to work to get people to look at your thing.
Yes.
Like, just even for a moment. Yep. And it feels like it's pulling teeth every time. So when it doesn't feel like that, you're like, oh, that's the time, that's where your effort can have the most impact. It's time to like pay attention to that. So like,
let alone using it, like
looking
at it and being like, cool, this seems really good and like a reasonable thing. Maybe one day I'll take a look at it. But that's very different than like, oh, I did this thing because
I have an idea for a game right now.
Yes.
And I've had people tell me that they've tried to write games for years and they've been in the hobby for like 20 years. They've tried to write games, have not been able to. And then the system came along and it kind of like unlocked the floodgates. And it's a really simple system. I even label the branding on it is an introductory game design SRT. So it gives you sort of, when I was a beginner, I was like, well, here's sort of all the basic tech that I've gathered from my initial readings of, you know, Wander Home and Lumen and these other texts, Lasers and Feelings, Blades in the Dark, all the other Powered by the Apocalypse games. So let me condense some of this stuff into like really easy to understand. And that's what the rest of the document did. So I expanded on it in a larger document that gave people like step-by-step instructions on like, here's how you assign stats and here's how to look at genre and here's like some tips and tricks. And it really took off. It's the other day I checked, it's like 22,000 downloads, which is outrageous. And I'm so grateful.
That's amazing.
Like, people were telling me, like, because I entered it into a number of bundles for trans rights, seeing as I am a trans person. And I've had people be like, oh, my friend, like, was talking about this D4 system that they got in the bundle that they can like make a game with. I'm like,
it's me.
That's me. That's wild.
Yeah.
So I don't think I'm particularly good at game design. I think one of my strengths, I think, is trying something new and not being afraid to be bad at it or look like I'm doing bad at it. It's like, hey, if it looks like I'm bad at it, that's because I'm bad at it. Yeah. that's the nature of being a beginner. And like being able to laugh at yourself and being able to be like, necessarily, I will not be perfect right now because I do not have the capability, experience, or knowledge to even attempt that. So you have fun with some failures and then there'll be plenty to be upset about later. Like you can just like have a good time now. I also created some more systems, kind of spin-offs based on I built Nighthawks on Caltrop Core, which was my debut game on the system. I wanted to show people that what the game could do. That's one where I wrote the game. It's based on the painting by Edward Hopper and it's a game about loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time after I wrote it, I was like, is this, because I was still pretty new to playing games. I hadn't played a ton of RPGs. I was like, is this even fun? Is this even a game worth playing? And I went to testing and like, it was a resounding yes. Like I had the answer. I could tell.
Yeah.
And so, we refined it a bit. And now it's also my first print publication.
Oh, I didn't know that that had already gone. I don't. I must have missed that. But congratulations, that's so cool. Thank you.
Yeah, I bought a bunch of copies. I sent to sent them to IPR. I have they're the ones who are distributing it. They've taken it to cons. Some shops have started buying it. So cool. And I have the soft covers up. They're like $12. They're like really not expensive at all. So if you know Indie Press Revolution, you can just go to there and probably search my game.
There will be links to all of the above in the show notes, including a Twitch play by Prayers in the Static, featuring several friends of Reckless the Talk, including Lex, playing through Nighthawks specifically.
Oh, it's so good. It's that Gwen really, I mean, all the people in that session just really got it. And it was a beautiful, heartbreaking, bittersweet, wonderful session.
Oh, absolutely.
That session is why there's now a section on bleed in the print version of the book, because it can get like that. But I was really proud of it, still am to this day. That one has a lot of expressive mechanics. And then I started designing other things on the system. I wanted to know if Celtic Core could support tactical combat or this, that, or the other. So I wrote a couple games and then realized I was doing kind of the same thing for all of them, which was you would roll 3d4 for all of them, and you would assign each result to a different part of the gameplay, a different like table or something.
Yeah, cool. Mm-hmm.
And I got the idea because Spencer Campbell from Hila RPGs was like going over Culture Core on stream one time, and I showed up, was like, that's awesome. I get to see him like kind of take a look at it. And he pointed out stuff that I hadn't noticed and all these things. But then he was also like, I wonder if there's a way to use the other numbers on the face of the D4. Because especially on the Caltrip, there's the other numbers on the face.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like, I'm wondering how to like use this extra information we have. And then that sort of unlocked a thing in my head. It was like, oh, like all the, there's so much information that we can continue to use beyond the highest roll. So it deviated enough from the original Culture of Core that I published a separate one called Culture of Core EX. And then I did a D8 system called Emerge 8, where you kind of create the abilities in the session with the GM by combining your stats. It's a whole thing. And I'm currently working on a D12 system called Dodeca, which I've built a couple of my Patreon games on.
Mm-hmm.
And it is weird and not, I'm like, I really did not think I would be making a lot more systems after Culture of Core, because I was just like, I mean, I did it, right? Like,
yeah, everyone, I made a system. There it
it's
is.
It's got 200,
the system.
Over 200 games on it. So, but I know I find myself loving tinkering with dice and how using the like probabilities, you can communicate really interesting things in art.
So do you, for Culture of Core specifically, I was, again, just even actually earlier today, it was just like, again, scrolling through the page where you have been collecting kind of like the ones that you have noticed or have gotten sent to you of people who have designed games on Caltrip Core. And it's huge. I tried to even have like a guesstimate of what it was so I could come in sounding educated. But it was like very immediately, it's like, I can't count this high. But it's tons. And the list was updated, I think it says on itch as of this recording, like 2 months ago or something. And like, I know people are still like messing around with it and still doing new stuff on it. So do you now have an appreciation for how not just popular it was, but how empowering it was for a lot of people? You know, like you said, like a lot of people were like, oh, I've been working at it for years to try and get a game. And then, oops, hey, here's this one that I put together a game in 15 minutes. And there you go. Like, is that something that you've been able to like really appreciate?
I mean, I kind of have to every day now, because it is really the thing that that's the reason I was invited to that panel and met those people that make me feel like, okay, I'm in the door in the industry. I couldn't have made this step trying full time without Culture of Core being a very large part of how I built my following. And because when you make, you know this, when you're like, when you start doing a certain type of content and you want to start doing a new type of content, the new type of content doesn't perform as well because your audience isn't used to it.
Yep.
And so it feels bad that it's less, but you can get through that a lot of the time and push through. So going from like funny subclasses for 5e, you know, for D&D, which everyone and their mom plays, and going to extremely, extremely indie stuff, where I've gone beyond the nerdiness of designing, of like designing like a setting or designing a game. Like I'm designing systems for people to make their own games. Like it goes even further. I'm like, I'm down in the like synthwave grid pattern of the hobby.
Yep.
Zooming around. I'm really grateful for it's like, I'm so glad that people have been able to make games and that they see Caltrip Core and by extension me as part of that process and part of that success for them, which is, I mean, like, I can't really ask for more impact in the TTRPG space. All I'm asking for now is like a few bucks a month so I can keep making weird stuff.
Yeah, but, right. Now you're just looking for financial impact in the TTRPG space. Yeah.
I mean, it's immensely satisfying to be like, here are the means of production. They're not so hard to operate, and people taking it and doing it.
Yeah.
I always have this idea for like a shitpost t-shirt of like, I made my own game on Caltrip Core and I used the money to buy this shitty t-shirt, you know, something like that. Because it's like, you can make a couple bucks. People have made some money.
Yeah.
People have found my system just through other people's games that happen to be Caltrip Core games, like Bloodless. Recently, someone commented on my page, was like, a lot of people love Bloodless. This is this like solo vampire RPG, one of those. Very cool. And that whole page was flooded with great reviews. And then someone came over to my page, was like, hey, just wanted you to know that, you know, I found this through Bloodless, which is great. And this is also, this system is great. I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. That's, you know, when you're not feeling mentally well, it's easy to look at the things you don't have. Especially like comparing yourself to other creators who you admire and being like, well, I wish people liked my games the way they liked their games, et cetera, all this stuff. But it's like, I did something accidentally, but extraordinary. So there aren't really words to explain. It's like the weirdest thing. And it's, I'm like very happy. There's, by my last count, in the whole family of SRDs, which is like, probably 80-90% Caltrip Core games, is like 236.
Wow.
It's literally so cool. Hundreds. And that's most of those came from the three game jams I held in the beginning. I do mean to get around to doing a game jam this year.
Yes, it's time for another one, baby. 2024.
Yeah, we're definitely going to have like some patron game jams and some game jams for everyone. We're going to have some play tests. That's if you join the Patreon, you can join a play test for Bunny Girl RPG or this blade will shatter. I do have Immortal Gambit out, which is out on my itch. It's pay what you want. You don't need Patreon or anything. It's you can download for free. It's a one page mecha game because I always love mecha games, but you know, I want to play in a Lancer campaign so bad one day.
Someone It'll let happen. Me in.
Someone is, I've tried a couple times. One time we got one going and then the pandemic hit and it's just like, gosh, dang it. But this one, I personally grew up on Gundam Wing on Toonami when I was a young child. And I went back and watched it as an adult, like maybe 10 years ago, and was like, oh, all the like the complex politics and like the emotions and it's a very poetic Gundam series
where
sometimes you're just like, I'm not really sure what's happening here. It's like, but like Trey's Kushinada is standing in a black void of stars and monologuing with a rose, so you know.
So it's got to be something.
It's got to be something, right? So in this game, you all like choose a role in a battle. There's like the mech, the pilot. There's the rival pilot and the rival mech. There's the battle captain. There's the all these people. You all play a different faction, and you have your different goals for the battle. And I'm gonna test that soon. I'm really excited for that. I was like really proud of that one. Because one page games are hard. If you're starting and if you want to do your first game, I don't recommend trying to do a one page game.
No.
It's not easier.
No, I've tried.
It's both harder in every way.
Yeah, both of the I have two games that I'm like sort of noodling on, and I think both of them started as like it's going to be an easy one page lasers and feelings hack or you know kind of deal, no problem. And here I am like 15 pages later or some bullshit.
Difficult.
Yeah.
Like, I think a short game, like if you're really going for just like a brief thing, 6 pages is like a good, like in my 6 to 10 pages is like a good small one. If you're at 15, you've got a larger game on your hands.
Yep. Yep. Oh yes, for sure. For sure.
But yeah, no, one page games are pretty difficult to design. So they seem really easy and elegant, but that just tells you how genius Lasers and Feelings is.
Yes.
Like, That is hard.
I think something that goes underrated when talking about layers and feelings, the formatting and small text size.
Yeah.
Because boy, they really...
you can print that bad boy out and you have all the room.
Yeah, it is size 9-8 font and is like as crammed as they can get. And I say this with appreciation, but even that as like a platonic ideal of a one-page adventure is still like they had to work. It seems like they had to work real hard to make this into one page. I want to talk a little bit about the creative process and genesis for you who has written so many different games, but on your own system, on other people's system, on new things. But you hit so many tones and genres and vibes and levels of mechanics. And you do, you know, just like it seems like at face value, a real wide breadth of styles of game. Mm-hmm. So I guess kind of first, where do you start? Like, what's other than, oh, hey, I made this SRD and maybe I should see if there's a game in it. Mm-hmm. You know, do you start with mechanics? Do you start with a story? Do you start somewhere in between? What's that usually look like for you?
It's a lot of following my own interests and generally I do start with like maybe some sort of interesting mechanic paired with like a very short weird blurb. Like legitimately the ship posts are great for game ideas because they do sum up something. The Kafka's Cheeseburger was a ship post. It was absolutely, I that was a tweet I made and then I turned it into a real game because it's just like, if you can encapsulate the idea in that sort of small tweet length format, you probably have a succinct enough like idea to start working on something, because that's the hardest part is getting that first.
For sure.
What am I even making? I want to make something. What is that feeling? Where does it go? How do I nurture it? How do I find things? I write down my ideas when I have them. I try to find like just the weirdest stuff that I find really interesting or would be a challenge. Like the Bunny Girl game came from a shitpost that was just like Bunny Girl OSR, which is, it's not going to be an OSR game anymore, but that's sort of like where the idea of it started. It's sort of combining mm-hmm. elements from different things. I think you'll hear a lot of creatives and people like that talk about bringing something from one field into another.
For sure. For sure.
And seeing it that way. So you could argue that like I'm doing that for poetry, but in gaming, like some of my games are more poetic. Mm-hmm. Like Hexfall is much more poetic and more of like a meditation on like, you know, suicidal ideation and depression. Thank you. And then I did all the pixel art for it too, which is wild. But
I know. And that alone is like one of my, this seems dismissive and I please take it in the spirit in which it is intended. The pixel art is like one of my favorite bits of it because it's so evocative of that feel of what the feeling of the game is.
Yeah.
Like adore that game and Nighthawks, like both are like, ooh, I will just like reread them sometimes just to make me happy.
that's so cool to hear. I think also when I have something that I want to explore, like writers and artists will relate to this. When there's something you want to explore, sometimes you just like start making a thing in order to understand it or in order to solidify the message in your head or like to ask yourself questions. So like I have a game that I still need to test, but the Ashcan is up on my itch page for free called No Good Deed Bleed 10,000 Hit Points. And it's sort of this anarchist sandbox thing with really weird experimental mechanics that they might not work at the table. They might clog up play. They might make it like just really unfun. I don't know until I get there, but I started that idea with just sort of Backrooms inspired type of deal, but really thinking about like, what does a world based on the values that I have actually look like? What are the steps that it would take to get there? There's factions and groups. There's the institution. There's the outside. There's all these sort of it's very heavy on allegory.
Yeah.
And that game came from me wanting to just express some ideas that I was having about what I was reading and also to give people a place to explore that and imagine a better world.
Yeah.
So whenever, you know, the most common response I get when I'm talking about a better world, a world without police, a world without these oppressive power structures. People say, I can't imagine a world without police. I can't imagine a world without this. It's like, okay, that might be true, but your failure of imagination is not a reason for the world to continue the way that it is. And so I think play can offer us a means of getting into those hard questions. Because you know what? I don't have an answer for how we keep vulnerable people safe. We don't do it now, but I don't have an answer for the future world either. So there's a lot of things where I'm thinking in my daily life, okay, well, that's the situation that a police officer took care of. What would that look like in a world without that power structure? And it's not an easy answer. Sometimes I don't come up with an answer. It's not easy. But I think the act of play, the act of role play and engaging with certain types of games, this one's much more open-ended and sandboxy and weird. Maybe we can imagine worlds that are not ruled by capitalism and by fascism and all that good stuff that rules our everyday life. Mm-hmm. Could we start playing? It's only hard to imagine until someone shows you what it looks like. One of the things that helped me a lot was an essay from a Black Anarchist Reader PDF that I got online. And the first essay was, I forget who it was, but someone, this woman from like the 1800s. And she was like, you know, sadly enough, a lot of the stuff she was saying was still true today, but we have made a lot of progress. She was saying, you know, like, everyone wants to know, how is this going to work? She was like, well, fine, I'll tell you. You know, so like, once I saw like a couple ideas laid out, I was like, okay, you can start there. And you'll probably find that a lot. You'll find the ideas in my games a lot of, like, I don't like to have like power structures unless they're meant to be dismantled in the game.
Yeah.
A lot of the times the setting, I'll try to make something where there's like guilds that interact with each other, or like there's some sort of governing bodies. Like when I say anarchist ideas, I don't mean everybody is just doing whatever they want all the time in chaos. And like, I mean like the like philosophy, which I owe a lot of what I've learned to the Black liberation movement in the USA, which American anarchism, Black anarchism has its roots in that versus like European anarchism. But yeah, it's more like, I think a world without oppressive power structures would be better.
yeah, right. Simple as that.
You know, hot take.
What's the hard part of game design for you, if there is one? Like, that's always something I'm interested in anyone who's doing a creative thing, but especially when they are doing it as a solo act. You know, like, not everyone can be good at every single thing or enjoy every single kind of aspect of it. Is there part of game design or of being a full-time game designer that is like, yeah, this is the work?
All the social media stuff was a lot of work. Oh, I did it for like, I was like basically grinding every day for 2 years. And now I don't grind so much. I'm just try to use what I have now. So it's helpful to get to that point. These days, it's hard for me to like get a playtest together. I think that's hard for everyone, but I'm definitely one of those people who I'm like, oh, I like to just generate a lot of stuff. And then having to go back and playtest it is hard. And it's, you know, anxiety inducing, it's nerve wracking. It's like, all right, well, you really don't know how that game's going to play till you get to the table, and it could just be bad.
Yeah, right.
I find
yeah.
the like, for the first game jam, I made a game that was like based on fighting games, and I tried to test it with my partner, and it was almost unplayable. It was, but almost.
almost unplayable.
There was a part of there that was fun, and eventually I'll go back to it. I'm thinking of converting that to the Emerge 8 system and maybe like trying to figure something out there. But I don't mind the revision part. I do like having the information. I don't like, it's like being back in workshop class or critique. You're like, all right, everyone, play my game and tell me if it's sucks.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
Oh, you didn't have fun. We spent 3 hours, 4 or 5 hours playtesting. You didn't have fun. That sucks. It feels bad.
Yep.
I don't mind the marketing stuff too much these days. I do mostly like more email and Tumblr, and it's not too bad. I did like writing emails a lot. That was easy for me. I wrote a ton for my last job. So it kind of is a well-worked muscle at this point. Layout is tough. You know, I'm not a trained graphic designer, and you can tell, but I've gotten a lot better over the years, and truly just brute force of make enough bad stuff and eventually it gets better. setting is hard too, because I know lots of people really love detailed settings and world building and stuff, and I really like mechanics and little levers to pull and all that stuff. So I do a lot of world building and setting stuff for each game, but only as much as is necessary, really, to get across the idea. And in the future, like, that's what I do for like first runs of games. And then once I go back and play test, and if I decide like, okay, I'm going to beef this one up, then I start adding more. Like Hexfall, the Game Jam version was a certain length, and then I went back and did a whole expansion and got some more stuff in there. And that's something I really like to do. I have like a version 0.1 usually, and then, you know, a couple versions in, we have something that's a little more polished. But yeah, you know what? I enjoy it, but most of the process is hard.
Yeah.
The hard stuff these days oftentimes is stuff that it's fun for me to figure out. So, even if it's like scary marketing stuff, I'm like, no new subscriber. What am I going to do? It's like, well, it's fine. I'll just send another email. You just got to kind of like put your head down, do the work. My intent is to make this like a publishing company. So Titanomic RPG will become like the publishing co, and I'll just be the head publisher or whatever. And eventually I'd love to publish other people's games. I just got to get a handle on my own first, but I would love to help people with the hard stuff, because a lot of it is, it's not hard. You just have to know how to do it.
Yeah, for sure.
Or like hard in, it's not hard in the way where it's like difficult. It's hard in the way where it's like, this is just it takes a lot of time, like time consuming work.
Something else that I know you've talked about a lot before, but I think is super, super valuable, and I think was a real kind of through line through a lot of the stuff that you just kind of touched on, was the idea of trying a lot of stuff, of just chasing down whatever you're interested in, finding ways to make it work, and then you're kind of putting it out there and then just kind of letting it exist and people try it on. But part of that is a degree of kind of failure, right? Is that not every game is going to work. Not every playtest is going to work. Not every meme game is going to go viral.
Pop off.
Exactly.
You never know.
And not every really sometimes personal thing, especially truly a lot of the games that you do where a lot of it is personal,
right?
Or at least kind of very influenced by personal stuff. There's a high risk of failure, and depending on how you define failure. Can you just talk a little bit to me about your experience and your views of confronting those sort of setbacks, of moments where it feels like you failed or that you yourself are a failure, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's hard for anyone really to deal with rejection, because failure can just be like, hey, you're learning to rollerblade and you fell on your butt, and that's funny. You can laugh at yourself. Maybe you got a scrape, whatever. It's fine. I think a failure in that sense where you're gonna do it wrong the first time. The first thing you make is gonna be bad. The first step you take as a baby is shaky and all this stuff. There are times when it feels like failure to me feels like rejection. And that's sort of why I brought that kind of emotion up early, because that's how it feels for me when it's sometimes, you know, because I have diagnosed major depressive disorder. I'm on 150 milligrams of Zoloft and it helps a lot, but it doesn't fix me, obviously. So when I'm having kind of the down days and thinking about the really personal stuff that I've put out, and then you can't help but look at like, oh yeah, the numbers on Caltrop Core versus this other thing, which is not a fair comparison by any stretch, and it never is, but in your mind, it's hard not to think that way. You have the numbers in front of you on your dashboard, you've got all this stuff, so it feels easy to fall into those thought patterns. But when it comes up, it comes up. Like, I don't have like a cure-all or anything. It's like you gotta try your best to not like anchor your happiness to the numbers and stuff, but also number go up is I mean, number goes burr.
Numbers are nice sometimes when they're good numbers.
When they're good, I love good numbers. I hate bad numbers.
Yeah, and I'm not just talking about like 420 as a nice number, but
also 69.
The bigger ones. Yeah, bigger numbers are 420, always 69. Gooder numbers, for example. Yes.
Yeah.
So That was something that I did. I kind of wanted to talk about because you and I were both entering into the sphere at roughly, definitely the same like generation ish of people. I think you hopped in again like
it was January 2021 where I started the Twitter account.
Got it. Yeah. So we launched October 2021 and we're around like a handful of months earlier. So, but like again,
same it's around the same
timeline. And I remember very specifically you slash the account following us was one of the like big early gets for our our Twitter affirmation level, you know, where it's like, holy shit, Lex followed us. Now things are getting serious. But, you know, kind of, and that was even, I think, before Caltrip Core stuff. Like, you know, already had some fun fun stuff and some good stuff. And then Caltrip Core exploded, you know, between you launching it, between the game jam, which I remember was like 100-some games in like a couple weeks, I think, right?
The first two game jams both did 92 games exactly, which was weird. So huge explosion. It was wild.
And that all also came in a period of time, at least for me and kind of anecdotally from other people that I've heard, in kind of like some high watermarks in terms of like enthusiasm in the space. It was busy. Everyone was inside during the pandemic. Everyone had free time to listen to shows and try new things and be on Discords that, you know, all that kind of nonsense. And then again, and then you drop Caltrip Core, which is used to make dozens, hundreds literally at this point, hundreds of games. And you've continued doing stuff after that. But something that I was really interested in kind of talking to you about is that you have been around long enough, not to make it be like, ah, yes, Lex, the old person who's seen it all. But like you've been around enough. You've talked very publicly about burnout, especially around being on social media and marketing and all of the bullshit therein. You've gone in kind of ebbs and flows of releasing games, of Patreon stuff, of all, you know, kind of everything. So I guess I just wanted to talk a little bit about what your experience of kind of that riding the waves of creation or being a public creator, I guess, capital P, capital C, has kind of been like for you and how you've weathered it long enough to, I mean, not to be like too much of a bummer, but like to still be doing it, you know, like not everyone that started with us is still doing it for a lot of reasons, but like including just like, yep, it's not for me anymore, or I just don't have the energy for it or the time or whatever. So yeah, what's your experience been like and how are you still here?
Well, I mentioned Zoloft earlier and that is the main one very big reason.
Reckless Talk therapy. This has been another episode. Everyone consider therapy might be right for you as our medication is great.
Like I really wish I had gotten on medication earlier, but you know, it's, I'm the second most stubborn person I know, second only to my own mother, who is the only person to have ever defeated me in pitched stubborn combat.
And the aforementioned mother,
So at first I was just doing it for fun because I liked it. And it was, you know, I had a job at the time that was paying well. So I had the luxury and privilege of being able to give stuff away for free and sort of just doing lots of fun, weird stuff and not have to worry about like bills or meeting the bottom line. So I was like, I can make things as weird as I want. This this job is quite a blessing at the, you know, at the time. And but yeah, it was like pandemic and I wasn't really hanging out. I still wearing masks because I have my own health problems. So I stayed inside a lot longer. So I had a lot of time to fritter away and I was working from home. So I was able to just like be on Twitter all day and Discords and stuff and kind of just put in the grunt work on the boss's dime. Depression makes it hard to, it's hard to say exactly how I'm still here. It's a lot of little things, I think.
Yeah, sure.
I guess one big moment of my TTRPG career was Big Bad Con 2022. April Kit Walsh, the author of Thirsty Sword Lesbians, emailed me to invite me onto her panel about open licensing and TTRPGs and fostering creative communities. And Jay Dragon was also on the panel, who is a huge game design idol of mine.
Yep.
I credit Wanderhome in probably like more than half of my games. Caltrop Core credits Wanderhome and Lumen by Gila RPG, Spencer Campbell. And being on that panel with also Viditya Valetti was incredible. And I flew out there. That Sean, who's at Evil Hat and runs the con and stuff, was able to find some money for me to fly out there last minute, because I woefully out of the con scene, and that's something I have to get. That's one of my things that I have to start doing now. But going there and meeting some of my game design idols in person, just hanging out with April, she was super nice and just like introduced me to a bunch of people. I got a picture with Matt Mercer, so that was great. And I also met Banana Chan there. I went to one of their panels, and then we exchanged contact info, and I was able to get some like TTRPG career like mentorship advice from them, like just how you pitch to a publisher, and you know, a lot of the kind of blind spots that I had. And it kind of took my confidence to another level of being like, okay, now I'm sort of established.
Like
Jay and April know who I am. That is Banana cool. Knows who I am. That's for sure something. And then we did the panel again online, with the online version of the con, like 6 months later. And I sort of just lucked into that with Caltrop Core. And sometimes you make a really, really cool thing and it works. I've had a lot of projects over the years. You know, I've had writing projects where I had like a personal letter project back in the day. I did it like for 3.5 years. I would send a letter every month. And I was practicing my like digital marketing skills to get readers. So I would like pay nano influencers on Instagram for story shout outs to get email signups. And I got it to like about 1,000 readers.
Bonkers.
And I ended up talking about life and everything. And also it ended up going in. By the end, we were talking a lot about social justice and the tragedies around the world. I think I stopped writing it in June 2021 because I felt like I had said everything I could say with the project. But I met a lot of friends from around the world because of that project. That was way before I was on Twitter. Throughout the years, I've always had like little projects going, maybe not like constantly, but looking back, I've always had something bigger that I was working on. Something that where I'm like, I could just endlessly tinker, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Lex, we are, as always, at the part of the interview that I find the hardest, which is the end. And it is hard for a number of reasons. A, because as expected, you have been a font of loveliness and of knowledge and just all kinds of great stuff.
Well, appreciate
and I have
it.
So many things that we didn't get to that I want desperately to hear you talk about, but we have, you know, like lives and brains
for
to
sure.
take care of and ways that we need to hydrate, you know, whatever else.
Ask your favorite podcast to have me on.
Yes.
And ask your favorite indie TTRPG podcast.
Unfortunately, everyone who listens to this show, this is their favorite tabletop role playing game.
Of course.
Show.
Sorry, your second favorite.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Everybody message your second favorite.
But the other hard part is that, no pun intended, is that we have also come to the Reckless Attack lightning round. You know, if for those who are not familiar with this dreaded gauntlet, we ask all of our guests the same questions in the same order every single time. There are no wrong answers other than, you know, just like lying, I guess, but that's just because it's lame. These answers can go on as long as you wish, or they can be as short as you want, including one word, including, you know, I don't really have a good answer for that. And no matter what you say, I will try to restrain myself from asking follow-up nonsensical tangential questions or making jokes. And I will sagely pause and nod. Ah, yes, that is an answer. Interesting. And we will go on to the next question. Lex, are you as ready as you can be for the Reckless Talk lightning round?
Believe I am as ready as one can ever be for the Reckless Talk lightning round.
Perfect. Best of luck. First question. Is your glass half full or half empty?
I like to think of it just, I've got a glass and it's got water in it. It is what it is.
What excites you creatively, spiritually, and or emotionally?
I am always happiest when I'm learning something new, especially from people who are really good at it. We did a 3-week beginner course in Wing Chun Kung Fu, and this dude was he'd been doing it for 20 years. It's just, those are opportunities that you just don't get every, like I was listening to Jay and April talk about game design. I was just like fangirling over everything that they said to me. So that's one of my happy places is learning something new.
What does not excite you creatively, spiritually, and or emotionally?
People who say that they're going to do something and then just keep talking about it and never do it. I'm like, don't talk to me about this. I'm the person who's always doing stuff. I have a whole mortality thing. So it's just like, I'm ready to go. I'm trying to get where I'm going because one day I'm not going to be here anymore.
What is your favorite sound?
Favorite sound. You know what? They got to be like a little kisses from my partner.
What sound do you hate?
Republicans. They make a lot of sounds.
Behold, me not making any further jokes or comments on a response. What's your favorite word?
I do enjoy... Oh, no, it doesn't say what word do you enjoy. It's what's your favorite. I do often these days like the word warmth. Mm. It has a really nice mouth sound, and it somewhat conveys that sort of like the at the end. It feels like cozy as well. I find myself thinking that that word is really does a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. What is your least favorite word?
The only one I can think of, and I forget where I heard this, it was, might have been just like someone's poetry or something. I got mad at when in college or something. I remember bitingly. That one really made me angry back when someone was using it. And I don't know why, but I remember it being, it just has like too much, it's two endings and, you know, go light on the adverbs as well, you know. But it's not the worst. It's not the worst word. Like, I don't hate the sound of it, but there's better ways to communicate that, I feel like.
I mean, I had a reaction to you saying it. So, like,
bitingly, yeah, legit. Bro.
What tabletop role-playing game, D&D, etc., monster or antagonist, have you never faced or run that you would love to?
I have never faced a Tarrasque, and I feel like that's just like a bucket list item for a lot of people. Totally. I'm not like particularly interested in fighting it, but I do find it pretty, it's nice to be able to say that you've done it. It's like you say like, oh, I've gone skydiving. It's like, oh yeah, I fought a Tarrasque. I do quite like the idea of fighting. I've run like a Lich before, but like I kind of made it my own. I would love to play in a party like fighting one or some other like high level wizard spellcaster type thing. That's for D&D. I would love to, again, Lancer. They've got some really cool mechs in there and I would like to pilot some cool ones, but also face like I think Horus is the one, like the really weird manufacturer. Of course, I'm really into like, they're like, we don't know where this tech comes from. I'm like, I want it. I want in. Yeah. That's what I'm here for. Those got to be my answers.
What is your favorite adventure of all time? And this can be a tabletop role-playing game adventure that you read, that you wrote, that you played in, that you consumed, that you watched someone else do. It can be 1999's The Mummy, whatever it means to you.
I might be a little biased because I wrote the subclasses for the game, but Fat Magic, it's a 5e source book. Shane Ormond did a wonderful job. They ran a playtest for us. It was probably the better part of a year. And we got through almost the whole adventure. They'll get like the last act left. And that The characters are all incredible. The names are so punny and funny. There's so much heart into it. There's lots of fun, like rise up and overthrow kind of ideas in there, which we love. And the Shane just put so much heart into that game, and playing that every week for a while. My character was a 13-year-old root druid, because I wrote a root druid with like potatoes and ginger and stuff. Yep. And they were like a half orc Azamar, like just a little goblin, not a real goblin, the little gremlin. But also I've had some like intense role playing moments. And the art is really good. The subclasses are funny, and I wrote them, and so that means they're even better, I guess.
I am an enthusiast. I will break my silence as impartial moderator of the lightning round to say I am also an enthusiastic Fat Magic supporter and adorer.
It's very good, especially if like most people into TTRPGs, they play D&D at some point. That one, I think the books should be out now, or they're just starting to come out. And yeah, that one's got to be my favorite for sure. Shout out to Shane.
What is your favorite tabletop role-playing game character of all time? Similarly, can be one of yours, can be an NPC, could be someone from a show that you watched, whatever it means to you.
It's hard not to love Sang, that character from that campaign.
It's totally like a right choice, not a problem.
The number of just hijinks that I would get into, and everything had to be food themed. So all my wild shapes had to be, so I had the crepe ape. I had the crepe ape. You can't talk in it. So I would just put a thumbs up and go, ooh, and everybody would love it. What was the panther? It was, it might have been like some sort of bread panther because of Pan. There's like some candy ones. There's all sorts of weird stuff that I turned into, and was also like a kind of exploration of also more leftist values in this setting, because there's like power structures there that you're interacting with. And, you know, my character's 13 years old, so they're just like repeating stuff that they've heard about, like, you know, power to the people and stuff. And then having to like see what that looks like as you actually, where the rubber meets the road, is like, was also where I was in my activism, and still am to this day, of like, okay, well, what's the real thing that I can do that's actually helpful, and not just talking, or not just doing something that puts a band-aid over it, you know? And I remember having just like beautiful and like very like real rage as the character, like, with people like making us clean up their messes throughout the whole story, you know? And at a certain point, like, I think my character almost died, and then like was just like, y'all gotta get your fucking shit together. Like, it was one of those where like people were like, after the fact, were like, are you okay? I'm like, oh yeah, no, that was just, but you know, that's how you know you role played really hard, is when everyone after is like, Are you really mad? I'm like, I was having a great time.
I was just getting some stuff out. Don't worry about it.
I thought it was a normal reaction for the character to have at this point in the story. Because it was like after all a bunch of just, I think I had jumped into a fireball to save my friends and all this, you know, wild stuff. That character, that character is definitely up there for me.
Lex, final question. What gives you hope?
I think the fact that life is just generally inherently worth living is a hopeful thing. Because I'm not like, I'm depressed, and I'm going to be depressed probably for the rest of my life. I'm not like holding out for anything, but it's from all the tough times I've gone through and trying to will myself to live, I think like believing that life is worth living is what will get you to the next day. And that's sort of my version of hope, I think.
Lex, Congratulations. You have made it not only to the end of the Reckless Atok lightning round, but Reckless Atok itself. As a reward for your excellence, could you please remind everybody who you have been, where they can find you, and how they can support you?
1,000%. Thanks for having me on, and thank you everybody for listening. I really appreciate it. Your time is irretrievable, so spending it here with us, it means a lot. And I've been Lex, Titanomachy RPG. All my stuff you can find at titanrpg.com, titanomachyrpg.com, the one redirects to the other, as well as calstripcore.com, which will give you kind of like a simplified version of the SRD. You just scroll through the page and it'll kind of, you could build the game just scrolling through this page. It's free. It's just, I just have it built so that people can reference it online. You can also find me on Patreon, patreon.com/TitanRPG, TitanRPG. That's where I'm putting a lot of my effort and focus these days. I'm releasing fully laid out games for the most part every month for tier 2 subscribers. We've got lots of weird stuff that is just real fun for me to make. And even if you can't, you know, downloading Caltrop Core for free and making a game is more than I could ever ask for anyone. So if you do that, it means just as much as any sort of subscription or anything. So yeah, LexTitanRPG.com. Check it out.
Links to all of the above in the show notes. Lex, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you very much.
Thank you, Nathan. This has been so much fun.
Bye.
Bye.